I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. Here's a mini rundown. There's one thing happening, the infrastructure bill. And yesterday, Chuck Schumer basically killed it. Republicans and Democrats have taken their bills to their respective caucuses. Five Senate Republicans reached a deal with five Senate Democrats on a $974 billion infrastructure package, according to the Capital Journal and the Wall Street Journal. And they tried to sell to the GOP conference on Tuesday, yesterday. However, yesterday, Democratic leaders started talks on a second infrastructure bill that they will attach to reconciliation. That's in the Wall Street Journal and also in the Washington Post. Democrats raise fresh alarms with emerging Senate infrastructure compromise. The liberals don't like the compromise, so they want to jump another $1 trillion or so into reconciliation. Well, look, if Republicans are negotiating a compromise bill with Democrats, and the other Democrats are saying, pass the compromise, then we'll add more stuffing in via the reconciliation. That kills the compromise. Why would the Republicans do that? They won't. They shouldn't. They should say no thank you unless you agree that's the end of the spending. Otherwise, they're just being dupes. And I don't think that's what the Democrats negotiating the compromise intended, but that's what Chuck Schumer decided yesterday. Wall Street Journal today, the rising stakes for the Fed. I'll talk about that with Brian Westbury. They can't keep printing money as the Democrats in the Senate and the House keep doing so. Some bad news as well. Retail sales dropped 1.3% in May. Pandemic habits have shifted. They're mostly online and people are not spending as much online, and they're not going back to the shopping centers. So it's kind of a worse for both worlds for retail. Lumber prices are falling fast, turning hoarders into sellers. That's the market for you. That's the market. Lumber went up, 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 up. Then all of a sudden, it started to go down, 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 down as hoarders turned into sellers. A federal judge, God bless him, in Louisiana, issued a preliminary injunction blocking the Biden administration from pausing new oil and gas leases on federal land. Judge Terry Doty of the U.S. District Court in Louisiana said the administration doesn't have the legal right to stop leasing. Good for you, Judge. The Biden administration has expanded a program allowing legal immigration for Central American minors so that if you are a child in the Golden Triangle, and that's Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala, and you have a permanent resident or even a parent or a guardian in the United States on temporary status, meaning they might get thrown out, you can come north on an airplane. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador have a lot of kids who want to come, and this is an attempt to stop those kids from walking up to the border. As opposed to having a border fence and the controls that Team Trump had in place, they're going to fly the kids in to the United States. Doesn't make sense to me. Won't make sense to the American voters. President Biden did a good thing yesterday. He tapped Lina Khan to chair the Federal Trade Commission. She was confirmed by the Senate on a big bipartisan vote. She is 32 years old. That's the same age that I was when I ran the United States Office of Personnel Management, which has more people and less authority. FTC has authority over big tech. This is actually a very welcome appointment. Chair Khan will do great things at the FTC to rein in the power of big tech. She thinks about it. She's active. She understands it. This is one of those cases where you have to go young to get someone who's actually spent a decade thinking about big tech, because big tech has only been a menace for a decade. Meanwhile, Senator Cotton and Congressman Crenshaw opened up a critical race theory whistleblower line for members of the military. It's gotten hundreds of tips. The battle for black voters in New York City's mayor's race centers on policing. The Girl Scouts are stuck with over 15 million boxes of unsold cookies. Bad news, Dennis Kucinich is running for mayor again in Cleveland. Please don't do it. Philanthropist Mackenzie Scott gave away $2.7 billion to 280 organizations. Good for her. The Theranos jury is being seated. China flew a record number of fighter jets into Taiwan's airspace yesterday. Geneva, as I said at the top of the show, is the setting for Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden getting together. More on that tomorrow. The photo op will be epic. Putin has been, just dunking on Joe Biden for a week now. We'll see what happens. America, bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. A lot ahead still on this show, including James Holman of the Washington Post, Josh Kroshauer of National Journal will be along. I'm going to have Representative Mike Gallagher, of course, and Brian Westbury, First Trust Portfolio Senior Economist, to talk about, quote, modern monetary theory and what it's going to do to us. And I'm debuting Smart Guys 2.0, Professors Adler of Case Western and Stephen Vladeck of University of Texas, right and left on the Supreme Court. They'll be next hour. Right now, though, Matthew Continetti joins me. You see him on Meet the Press. He writes for The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and most recently in The Washington Free Beacon about the Chinese Communist Party. Good morning, Matt. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
I want to begin with a news story that plays into your column, How to Make China Pay. Yesterday, China flew 28 military aircraft into Taiwan's air defense buffer zone. That is an all-time high. 20 fighter jets, 4 nuclear-capable bombers, and anti-submarine warfare and early warning aircraft. This has become a regular feature of the Chinese Communist Party's reflex to developments they don't like, such as the G7 statement that China is a bully who must be contained. What do you think it is saying vis-a-vis Taiwan? And it does tie directly into your article, How to Make China Pay, because I think it is the most obvious way that we make China pay.
Right. Well, I mean, this sortie is just the latest sign of Chinese belligerence toward Taiwan. It shows that Xi Jinping, the Chinese communist leader, is not deviating from his course, his intent to dilute American power, displace America from a role in the Pacific, and then eventually dominate the world. What I try to make the point in my piece, is that whether or not the lab leak theory is true, and I think the circumstantial evidence points that it is true, whether or not that is the case, we know that the Chinese Communist Party covered up the virus once they began becoming aware of it at the end of 2019. We know that critical time was wasted because of the Chinese government's lies. And so we need to think about how we're going to impose some type of cost on China for what it did to the world with the pandemic. And the first idea, and I think in some ways the easiest for America, would be to increase our engagement with Taiwan, which is under siege, which is a democracy, which shows that there's no cultural barrier to Chinese democracy and freedom, and which is next on China's list. You know, I mean, they've absorbed Hong Kong and are slowly whittling away all the freedoms in Hong Kong. And the next on the list for the Chinese Communist Party is reclaiming Taiwan.
In fact, it is, according to many of the Chinese experts that I talk to, or experts on China is how I should put it. Some of them are Chinese Americans, some are not. I think of Dr. Miles Yu and Dan over at AEI, and of course, every member of the Nixon seminar, that the completion of President General Secretary Xi's agenda has to be done by the 100th anniversary of the revolution's conclusion in the First Party Congress, and that means soon. They're looking at after the Olympics of 2022, much in the way that Putin used the Sochi Games to kick off his invasion of the Crimea. What do you think about that, Matt?
Well, I think it's an alarming thought, Hugh, because I'm not sure America is prepared to defend Taiwan, which is something that we would be called upon to do and what we would have to do, I think, according to our agreements with Taiwan, and also just because it would be the right thing to do. I'm not sure we're ready in the United States, and part of that is look at our defense budget. Right now, we have a situation where, despite wanting his, $6 trillion plan to go through the Congress, President Biden has proposed no increase in defense spending. And when you add in inflation, it actually amounts to something of a cut.
Well, it does.
The Chinese see that. They know that. And they take that as kind of a green light.
In your article, you cite a study, a March 2020 study. Now, I'm leery of studies on epidemiology, given the big swings and misses we had early on. But this is March 2020. So they probably, whoever the source is, they probably had better approaches to the modeling that cases of coronavirus might have been reduced anywhere from 66% to 95% if the Chinese authorities had acted earlier. And by that, I assume they meant posted the DNA earlier, told people especially about asymptomatic person-to-person transmission, which is what made this epidemic so much different from Ebola and everything else. That changed the game, Matt, and they hid that.
That's right. And that I think, is where we most clearly can say China is at fault. And it does raise the issue of, okay, well, why were they hiding it? What were they doing? It shows in a closed society, in a communist collectivist society like China, all the rules of bureaucracy, all the cover-ups, all the passive buck that you find in bureaucracy, those are magnified tenfold, hundredfold. And that's what you have in China. And this study that I mentioned in the piece is a British study, I think. It came out, like you say, very early on. But it makes a commonsensical point that the earlier that you recognize the reality of the virus and the earlier that you intervene to stop the virus, then you're going to have fewer cases. And we have that critical month here between December 2019 and late January 2020, when the Chinese government was continually covering up and censoring all of the Chinese doctors, the whistleblowers, the heroes, the first heroes of this pandemic, who are saying this is a massive public health problem. It does transmit from person to person. And those messages were being deleted by the Great Firewall of China, censored by the authorities. If we had had an earlier warning system of the Chinese government actually acknowledging the truth, then maybe we would have been able to take precautionary measures.
Oh, man, I got to tell you, I remember so vividly in January and February of last year, I drove my audience a little bit crazy because I would talk every day about the danger of allowing people in without contact tracing. And we had a case in Orange County, California, where I was at that time, and they wouldn't tell us where the passenger landed or where the passenger went or where the passenger was being treated who was ill with coronavirus. And I kept making the point, what if it's transmissible while they were in the air? And clearly it wasn't. They didn't tell anyone because China didn't tell us. We would have reacted completely differently. They are guilty, guilty, guilty. But of the things you suggest, only the measures increasing Taiwan make sense to me, because we're not going to impose a carbon tariff. We're just not going to do that because of politics in America. And we're not going to do anything else. But we can, for example, every Republican who wants to be president, they should go to Taiwan. They should make Taiwan the trip that we normally make, you know, the three I's. They should add the T, Taiwan. And if you're Mike Pompeo or Tom Cotton or Ted Cruz, you ought to go to Taiwan in person, as I believe Chris Christie told me he would do on this show last week.
Yes, and I think even Mike Pompeo said that he's planning a trip as well. And look, this is an important ally. Historic ally, and the truth is, it's only been in the last 5 years, many ways, thanks to President Trump, that America has become aware of the China threat. And so now I think it's time to start acting like it. And even if we're not going to impose a carbon tariff, the very fact that we would be discussing it, I think, would make China think twice and recognize that America is not going to just sit idly by and believe in this myth of China's peaceful rise. And we know that China intends to displace us in the Pacific. It wants to dominate the world, and it's time to start acting like it.
It's interesting you mentioned President Trump. I think that might get us taken down by YouTube. I think they have a policy against saying anything good about President Trump. But to your other idea about stripping sovereign immunity, we actually lose that competition, because if they strip us of sovereign immunity, they can flood their courts, which are crooked, with an incredible array of lawsuits against American producers and the United States. They'll just make stuff up and they'll get judgments. So sovereign immunity, I don't agree with that. But I do agree, maybe proposing a carbon tax would make them think. But selling advanced anti-aircraft defense and strategic defense, Iron Dome to China is the message to Taiwan, is the number one message we can send. And maybe some F-35s, though we have, and last word to you, we have dangers of technology transfers through the fifth cadre, the fifth column in Taiwan.
Right. No, and I look, I mean, anything we can do to support Taiwan's position, I think it's is valuable. And I do think, look, the Biden administration has kept up kind of the political engagement that began under the Trump administration. It's been sending delegations to Taiwan, and it's that has annoyed the Chinese. And so my message is keep it up and then think of everything else we can do that might embarrass China, weaken China, and thwart its plans to displace American power.
Because it's going to be decades and decades, Matt. This is not a short-term deal. This is a... some people don't like Cold War II, but do you use the term?
Oh, yeah. New Cold War, Second Cold War. It might last decades, but that's no reason to delay.
That's no reason to delay recognizing what's upon us. Matthew Continetti, thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Continetti. Follow me to the next segment on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I am joined by Congressman Mike Gallagher from the great state of Wisconsin. Good morning, Congressman. Where do we find you today?
You find me in Washington, D.C., Hugh.
Inside the Beltway. Terrific. You were back in Yorba Linda last week at the Nixon Library, in fact, and I'm glad you had a chance to go through. But you sent me a picture of you in front of President Nixon wearing number 12. Why did you do that, Congressman?
Well, it happens to be the number that Aaron Rodgers wears. And so I just thought it was fitting that you'd be promoting the Packers at the Nixon Library. Now, I'm sure this is where we pivot to some joke about how Aaron Rodgers may not come back to play for the Packers. So let me just preempt you on that one, Hugh. It's a mess right now at Lambeau Field. I fully recognize that. But good old RN wore the number 12, like the
Aaron
Rodgers.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between your Belinda's number 12 and Green Bay's number 12. You know what that difference is?
No, but I have a feeling you're going to tell me right now.
Nixon never quit. He always came back. He always went for it on fourth down, Mike. I mean, there's a big difference. He always came back. He got knocked down but he always came back.
I'm writing the greatest comeback right now. The story of how Aaron Rodgers returned and won three Super Bowls in his twilight years.
That requires a contract and a quarterback. I just don't think all the excitement's in Cleveland. I'm still telling you, come on over. Now let's get serious because I got a lot to talk to you about. Yesterday, the Chinese Communist Party sent 28 planes into Taiwan airspace, the largest air flotilla ever, including 20 fighters and 4 nuclear-capable bombers, anti-submarine warfare, and spy planes. What's your reaction to the largest incursion into Taiwan airspace ever by the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, simultaneously, we were having a hearing on the Armed Services Committee with the Chief of Naval Operations, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the Acting Secretary of the Navy. And I asked all of them whether they agreed with Admiral Davidson's recent assessment that the PLA could make a move on Taiwan within the next 6 years. And they all agreed. So our highest naval officers are telling us that the situation in Taiwan is growing more dire, more urgent by the day. And the PLA saber rattling, I think, is going to continue to get worse as our adversaries perceive there to be a period of opportunity where they can test American deterrence and potentially get away with something as ambitious and bold as effectuating the unification of Taiwan with the mainland. I would also highlight a recent piece in Foreign Affairs by Oriana Schuyler Mastro called The Taiwan Temptation, in which she lays out all the reasons why she could actually make a move on Taiwan, some of the recent messaging from high-level PLA officers. All of these things, I think, are conspiring to create a situation in which, as American deterrence collapses, as America projects weakness on the world stage, she thinks he can get away with something very, very dire. And if indeed he's successful, I mean, that would completely undermine U.S. credibility throughout the entire world. So this is a very dangerous situation. All the more reason why we need to get serious about building the Navy. The budget we have from the Biden administration is a joke. The officials we had in front of the Armed Services Committee yesterday admitted that we're not going to get anywhere near 355 ships under this budget. We're actually cutting the amount of money by $2 billion that we're using to build warships. We're doing some very illogical things right now. We are underfunding defense at the time. We're finding money for every domestic discretionary priority under the sun. And it should not surprise us that our adversaries are testing us in Taiwan and in other places around the world.
Now, Matt Cotton was on in the two segments ago arguing that the way to act against China for their cover up of the virus, which killed probably millions as a result of their cover up, is to he gave three suggestions. I don't think we're going to strip sovereign immunity, and I don't believe we're going to impose a carbon tax, but we can increase aid to Taiwan, including missile defense. And increasingly, we've got to increase the submarine fleet in the South China Sea. That's why the NATO statement encouraged me. And I want to give props to Team Biden when I can. They said, let's bring NATO into the South China Sea. I got a note from a retired Marine Corps general say they can't help us there. Well, they've got between 30 and 40 submarines, not counting the UK submarines, which I assume patrol the South China Sea anyway. If there is an attempted move on Taiwan and it's actually opposed, it will be up to the submarine fleet to do something about it if the decision is made, unlikely as it might be, that the Biden administration would oppose with arms any move on Taiwan. Don't we want submarines in the South China Sea, Congressman?
We do. It's our most survivable asset. And then particularly if you assume that our communications, particularly our exquisite communications or satellite communications, would be degraded in any sort of high-end conventional fight, all the more reason why subs are important. They have the ability to do things in the absence of such communications. And I, too, welcome any enhanced cooperation with our allies, particularly when it comes to our naval presence in the Indo-Pacific. I just would say even the most efficient use of existing resources, both our resources as well as allied resources, aren't going to be sufficient to this task. It is going to require an investment. It is going to require us building out our Navy in concert with our allies. And right now, the Department of Defense and the Biden administration have simply not done that. They have not submitted a budget that is serious about confronting China right now. And so while I welcome the NATO statement and I welcome more of our allies putting assets in the Indo-Pacific, we're going to have to build more ships, particularly not only subs, but smaller ships. The frigate is absolutely critical. The incoming Secretary of the Navy, should he be confirmed, Del Toro, needs to understand that his legacy, his success or failure, will be determined by the success or failure of the frigate program. We need that on budget. We need that on time. We don't need the Navy adding a bunch of requirements and changing a bunch of requirements. It's a proven design. We need to get it out there in the fleet. And then finally, we need to take advantage of the fact that we're no longer bound by the strictures of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and field intermediate range ground launch missiles throughout the First Island Chain and field the small teams of Marines that the Commandant has been talking about with his force design for the last 4 years. So it's critical time. Just quickly, Hugh, on your note about China, I would note that I think the Biden and the communique we got out of the G7 about the WHO investigating the origin of the virus is a joke. The WHO is not going to suddenly rediscover its credibility and do a transparent investigation. It's up to us, in concert with some key allies, the Australians, the Brits, and others, to lead this investigation. I hope this 90-day intelligence review reveals something. I'm somewhat skeptical. We're going to need to lead an independent investigation. We can't rely upon the thoroughly corrupted WHO to do that investigation.
Well, let's stick on hardware for a moment, Congressman, because I think you can plus up the defense budget. And if, in fact, earmarks come back, you can work to actually get your Democratic senator to work with you to send more frigates up to your facilities in Wisconsin and to open up a second frigate assembly line, whether it's on the Mississippi or the Ohio or anywhere else that they can build these. Because it seems to me the three classes of ship, we need our carriers, obviously, for a lot of different things besides China deterrence. But we need those guided missile frigates. And I'm just copying what China did for the last 30 years, which is an area denial, access denial strategy. You need submarines and missile ships, porcupine ships. You're making them in Wisconsin. They can be made elsewhere. But we need a legion of those, and we need a legion of submarines. I believe there is only one submarine in the budget, and I don't believe they've accelerated the acquisition of the second frigate. And we should be turning out tens of frigates and submarines every year.
I agree. I mean, you know, destroyers are also critical. It's the one system we've proven that we can build pretty reliably. We need to be building more of those. My colleague Elaine Loria had a great segment pointing out inconsistencies in the budget yesterday. You know, I have a lot of hope for autonomous systems going forward, whether they're autonomous surface vessels or whether they're underwater autonomous vessels, but we're still years away from that. And so we can't just punt all of our investments to the future and hope for some third offset to emerge and suddenly technology is going to solve this problem. We need hardware in the field right now, proven hardware, and that's subs, that's small surface combatants, that's destroyers. And then we need to fix the range of the carrier air wing. You know, we've had a successful test of this so-called MQ-25 refueling platform. That's promising. But again, that's a 2025 scenario. This U is the fundamental problem with how the Navy is approaching this. All of our plans go out to 2045. We're planning on a very distant scenario. But the reality is we need to be planning on a 2025 scenario, if not sooner.
2022, the Winter Olympics are 2022.
And we need a crash program for fielding a deterrent capability in a few years, not in a few decades.
Congressman, we're eight months away from the Winter Olympics. 8 months. And if they do the Sochi thing, that's the opening of the window. Question out of the political side. Chris Christie told me last week on this program he will visit Taiwan. I talked to a high-ranking former official yesterday. They're going to Taiwan. I expect former Secretary of State Pompeo to visit Taiwan. I think the visit to Taiwan for a would-be Republican president is going to be as absolutely necessary a visit to Ireland and Israel. What do you think?
I agree with that. I'm sort of thinking of the Eisenhower, I shall go to Korea, speech as you say that. And I'd be happy to stow away on whatever plane that Tom Cotton is chartering to go out there. So if he puts me in a suitcase, you know, I'm happy to carry his bags. I'm fast.
Aaron Rodgers would fit in a suitcase.
Yeah.
Yeah. That.
But I agree with you. And I've noticed that this has kind of become your Virginia class question, you know,
Ohio class.
Sorry.
Get your states right.
I remember advising Governor Walker when he did his first interview with you. I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, this is what Berlin was to the old Cold War, the early Cold War. And so I think any Republican candidate needs a credible plan for deterring a CCP invasion of Taiwan. This is not an outlandish scenario. The final thing I'd say, Hugh, is that we really need to do better outreach to the financial community, which continues to invest billions and billions and billions of dollars in Chinese military-affiliated companies. And to the extent they're even thinking about a Taiwan scenario, it's a very distant tail risk. To the extent they're pricing in the political cost of slave labor in Xinjiang province, it's a very distant scenario. So we need to break down the silos between the national security community and the financial community, because it's absolutely critical. In some ways, the critical domain of competition right now is financial, and we need to wake up to that.
I want to squeeze in one quick question, Mike Gallagher. Taiwan is not a domino. It's the whole game. Do you agree with that?
I agree. It would be the complete collapse of America.
Yeah, your internet is breaking up. That's why I thought you were in Green Bay. But anyway, Congressman, good to talk to you this morning. They don't have internets up there yet, but we'll work on that. And boy, I hope you can keep Aaron Rodgers at least talking to the fans in Green Bay. He doesn't like the fans there for some reason. Time to talk to Mike about Relief Factor. There's Nixon. There's the old one. Ben came through at the end. ReliefFactor.com. We got to get that to Aaron Rodgers. Then maybe he'll stay in Green Bay. ReliefFactor.com. And I don't ever see Gallagher when I'm out running. He says he runs a lot, but I never see him out on the byways and highways and the CNO bike path and the canal in D.C. or on the mall. I don't know where he runs. Maybe he's a treadmill guy. I've never been a treadmill guy, but ReliefFactor.com for young runners, for old runners, for walkers in between, for everyone who does anything that requires activity. Relief Factor supports the relief of the temporary aches and pains that come along with it. Tens of thousands of people take it every morning. I remind you every day to take it before you leave. And if you have a bag in your car, then you'll never go, oh, I should have had that. Brian Westbury is coming up. Modern monetary theory. What is it? Why is it a threat? Brian will explain after the break on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Brian Westbury is our show's official economist with First Trust Portfolio on Twitter. It's Westbury, and he promised today in 6.5 minutes to explain MMT, Modern Monetary Theory. Brian, good luck. You have the floor.
Well, first of all, it's not modern, and it's not monetary, and it's not really a theory either. But it has that official sounding name, and what it says is that the government, especially a government like the United States with the world's reserve currency, can borrow as much money as it wants and spend it and print as much money as it wants with really no downside. And that's why I say it's not modern, it's not monetary, and it's not a theory, because this has never worked. And believe me, governments have tried it over centuries and centuries, millennium, actually. And it always leads to devaluation of the currency, inflation, and misery for the population. I guess the latest example of this is, Venezuela. And if you go to look at the hyperinflation that is in Venezuela, it has been a disaster for that society, that country.
Wall Street Journal this morning warns, Brian, about the Fed again refusing to take inflation into account. Under modern monetary theory, is it not just the reserve currency that is considered to be invulnerable to overproduction of it?
Yeah, exactly. Which means they, what they're saying is that production in that economy will keep up with money printing, because in the end, the value of a dollar. So I'll act like a professor here for a second. If you have 10 apples and $10, and that's your economy, then each apple costs a dollar. If you increase the number of dollars to, let's say, 20, but you still only have 10 apples, now each apple costs $2, and that's inflation. Well, if the number of apples increases to 20 as well, so in other words, output keeps up with money printing, then each apple still costs a dollar, right? So you have 20 apples and $20. Because everything doubled. But that's the wish. That's what comes out. That's what's not theory. There is no proof that if you just print money, that output or the number of apples or the number of goods and services that an economy produces grows at all. And in fact, yesterday we saw this. We're giving all this money to people. Retail sales, what people spend, that's up 18% from February before COVID. So from February of 2020 through May of 2021, up 18%. Industrial production in the United States, what we produce, has actually declined by 1.4%. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we're printing all this money and then giving it to people to spend. In other words, Henry Ford increased the pay of his workers to $5 a day. First of all, he had a tough time keeping workers, but then raising their pay helped. But second of all, by giving them $5 a day, they could buy what they produce. Well, today what we're doing is we're giving money to people to buy things that they don't produce. And they're, because they're not working, because they get paid not to work. And so that's where this is all falls apart. When you print free money and start handing it out, it makes it feel like you can get something for nothing. But in the end, the price we pay is inflation and a decline in living standards because of this growth in government.
And I believe your Apple's example is best understood as being replicated in the real world in housing prices and in cryptocurrency. All this money's got to go somewhere. They're going into long-term assets of value, and they're going into speculation. Do you agree with that, Brian?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. But it's also happening in commodities, like in just about everything. I mean, lumber prices, you build a house these days, you need to get the 2x4s delivered in a Brinks truck. They're so expensive.
Fell yesterday. Lumber began to adjust yesterday as hoarders began to put their supply up. But that's a limited price drop because there's only so much that's hoarded.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's just temporary. And so the problem is when you get all of this money, Milton Friedman told us, too much money chasing too few goods. That would be too few houses. In this case, the demand for cryptocurrency rises relative to its production. That too much money raises the price of everything. That's inflation.
Brian Westbury, always a pleasure. That's Modern Monetary Theory, a dressed-up way of saying print money. It didn't work for the Continental Congress. It didn't work for the Confederacy. It didn't work for Weimar Republic. It did not work for Venezuela. It will not work for us. More coming up in Hour 3 of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. As we speak, President Biden and President Putin have shaken hands in Geneva with the Swiss president. They are now going to enter into the small meeting with just their foreign ministers, or the Secretary of State in our case, Foreign Minister Lavrov in their case, Secretary of State Blinken, Foreign Minister Lavrov, and interpreters. Then there will be larger meetings throughout the day. We'll get a readout at the end of this. I knew it was a certainty that President Biden would not do the meeting alone with President Putin because of the Trump criticism that occurred in Helsinki. I'm joined now by James Holman, columnist for The Washington Post. Also, he has begun a new podcast. Please go on. James, good morning. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh.
I want to talk to you about Please Go On. I have been reviewing online television cable ratings. Are you aware of how badly they've crashed, James?
Yes, very, very much.
Very. I mean, I now have in any hour more adults 25 to 54 than most of the cable shows get in their entire run. And so I'm thinking to myself, that's because I've got the morning commute and they're not watching TV, they're listening to radio. What happened? What happened to these networks?
Well, I think, a lot of the networks have become very predictable and you know exactly what you're going to get when you turn them on, unlike your show where it's you have core convictions, but you don't just kind of hew to a party line. I think everyone was sort of addicted to Trump, and the interest level has died down. I think Biden is trying very intentionally to be as boring as possible and to not create cable-worthy drama. And so a lot of people, whether they loved Trump or hated Trump, were tuned in, and now they're not.
I have another a piece of proof of that. On Monday, I interviewed Leader McConnell. Fairly routine interview. It lasted 15 minutes. I asked him obvious questions. I've been doing this for 30 years, so I knew what to ask him. He answered, I thought, in a predictable way, except for a proposed vacancy in 2023, and he answered hypotheticals because the leader answers questions. He knows what he believes. It went everywhere. Now, it wasn't the McConnell audio was used everywhere. Most of the cable channels did not credit it for whatever reason. It's not very professional, but they didn't credit. Ruth Marcus did. It went everywhere. Here's my theory. There is no news. It's just a news desert. So anything that remotely looks like a news, people go and hunt it. What do you think?
I think that's absolutely right. Totally agree.
Why is there no news?
I think that the Biden White House is trying not to make news. And this is his first foreign trip. And even now, I think what they would tell you, being charitable to them, is that they're trying to lower the volume, turn down the temperature. But a lot of even the infrastructure talks on Capitol Hill, on any given day, they're newsless. And you do see the media sort of trying to make a storyline out of kind of boring, long slog conversations. And so I agree with you. There is kind of desperate desire for news that approximates something like what everyone became habituated to over the last 4 years.
And I think one of the stories is going to be the news desert and the collapse of cable in a very short period of time. People are going to look at those numbers and realize there's a shift going on. But I have a couple of other theories. One, the news is made abroad and cable is afraid of foreign news. Taiwan yesterday had 28 People's Liberation Army airplanes invade its airspace, 20 fighters, 4 nuclear bombers, 4 other kind of planes. That's the highest ever. And it's a signal that China may be getting ready to invade. It's a signal that they're unhappy with NATO. But it's a big story. It's covered nowhere except the foreign press. Number two, confirmation bias just isn't entertaining. And that's what the cable channels will come at. Number three, James, and this goes to your podcast. Please go on. Podcasts are interesting. Cable news is not. Talk radio is interesting if you do it like I do, or NPR does it. I'm NPR for the right and they're NPR for the left. But I think podcasts are filling the void. Expand on that and tell me about Please Go On.
Yeah, absolutely, Hugh. So the first interview was with Kamala Harris, but we're going to talk to people across the ideological spectrum. And basically the premise is that we run lots of really interesting op-eds every week. You're obviously a contributing columnist, but we're talking about kind of outside voices. And so the goal is to pick one either really important or insightful or kind of interesting op-ed each week, and then to have a longer conversation, 20 minutes, with the author of that op-ed to kind of unpack some of their arguments, maybe push them on some of the assertions that they make, and have a little debate. So I pressed the vice president on people not working because of these supplemental unemployment benefits. And we went back and forth and she said, no, everyone wants to work. And I said, well, that's not what I'm hearing from businesses. And so we had a back and forth about that. We're just kind of unpacking the issues in the op-ed. So I think it's a good way to, as you know, when you're writing for print, you only get 750 words.
James, I got to follow up on that.
Go a little deeper.
Yeah. Did that make news in the way that the McConnell interview made news? I have a theory here. I don't think it made news. It should have made news. Did it make news?
It didn't, unfortunately. And it was newsy. What happened was I interviewed her, and then the very next day, the White House, both Biden himself and Jen Psaki, the press secretary, basically changed course. So I think Harris was uttering what the Democratic talking point has been. And it's clearly not true. And you saw Jen Psaki say Republican governors have every right to end these supplemental unemployment benefits early, which was at odds with what Harris had said. So I do think that sort of the some of it was overtaken by events, and some of it was, I think that there is a tension there where Democrats have struggled to come up with a good answer for why there's this problem in the job market.
All right. Now, I have a theory, James, and so far be it from me to tell Fred and Ruth and the gang at the opinion section of the Washington Post how to run their publicity machine. Did you transcribe the interview?
We did. We published a transcript on the web.
When did you publish it?
At the same time as the podcast. Part of the issue, I think, was that the podcast, we interviewed her the week before, and then it didn't run until the following Friday. So the news sort of, we talked before she went to the Northern Triangle. And so it kind of somewhat was overtaken by the Lester Holt interview where she kind of stumbled on not going to the border. So that, but part of
James,
that,
would you serve a sandwich with week old bread?
Well, we're launching a new product. We're not as agile as you.
Week old bread, James. I mean, you got it. I drive the staff here crazy. Dwayne sits there and transcribes until it's done immediately after the show and posts it because the news cycle. Interesting. Right. Now, you're going to go on and find other people. I think you ought to put the transcript up immediately. You ought to put it out without editing, and you've got to then have a push out list. Did you push it out in terms of here are the 100 reporters who generate news at the cable and the newspapers, the big five and the big five. Did you do that?
No. And that's a good idea.
You young people out there, you millennials, and I know, okay, boomer, but we've been doing this for 30 years. We know how to make news. And if you do, and you do good interviews, you know what you're doing. So you got into it, you sparked it up a little bit.
Yeah, and that's the goal, it's
politely.
That's the hope.
Well, it is interesting to me, and I'll be listening. The other last bit of advice, time spent listening on a radio show is closely monitored. And we know that the average time spent listening began at about 23 minutes. I think it's up to 27 minutes now. So I don't believe any podcast should be less than 23 minutes. And so you'll never see a podcast from us. Never. It's very rare. And you said 20 minutes. I think that's a little short, James. Why did you settle on 20 minutes?
The idea was to be able to not be the only thing that people are listening to on their morning. It's a weekly podcast. I think part of it is for the last 5 years, I've been doing a morning news briefing for like smart speakers for the Post, where I basically summarize the news in 10 minutes. And we discontinued that when I moved over to become a columnist. So I'm used to sort of bite-sized quick hits on the news, and wanted people to be able to listen to a variety of different things. But I agree. I think 20 minutes is a good amount of time to have a little bit of a longer conversation. But I'm someone who likes to listen longer.
And so, we do have some P1s who go for 3 hours and people who subscribe to the universe. But the podcast of the interview is typically between 30 and 45 minutes. Last question. Who is your next guest on Please Go On?
Katie Hobbs, the Arizona Secretary of State, who is running for governor there and actually wrote an op-ed for us today criticizing Kristen Sinema. And so there's some interesting Democratic tension and conflict there.
Two Democrats in a row, James?
Well, next week will be Republican.
All right, we'll see. James Holman, good to talk to you. Follow him at James Holman. Read his columns at thewashingtonpost.com and listen to Please Go On. And James posted the same day. I'll be right back, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172.
'Cause we can't see eye to eye. There ain't no good guy. There ain't no bad guy. There's only you and me, and we just disagree.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. This is the first episode of Smart Guys 2.0. For 20 years, John Eastman, Dean Emeritus at Chapman Law School, Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean at Berkeley Law School, would gather when I was afternoon drive on the West Coast, but they no longer are even awake. And so I've recruited two new law professors. Jonathan Adler of Case Western Law School, he is a law professor from the center right. And Steve Vladek is a law professor at the University of Texas. He is center left, and they are Smart Guys 2.0. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome. I want to begin with an open-ended question about your approach to the Supreme Court on the originalist living constitution spectrum. Where are you, Jonathan Adler?
I'm definitely an originalist. I think that that's the best approach and the proper approach to interpreting the Constitution and resolving constitutional questions.
And Steve Vladek, where are you?
I think, Hugh, I guess I take a bit more nuance to it. I think there are some provisions that only make sense to be interpreted by reference to what the founders understood the text to mean. And there are some provisions where the founders clearly meant for us to be looking at modern considerations, like the prohibition on excessive fines. I don't think they meant excessive fines as of 1791.
Now, good. Well put and well defended. That's it. We've got the spectrum of responsible constitutional opinion. Now, I try and play referee here and just throw meat into the ring. I don't have opinions on this. Jonathan, Mitch McConnell said on this show on Monday he would not, if he has the majority back, confirm a justice in 2024. If a vacancy occurred, he left open the question of whether he'd do it in 2023. Your reaction?
I'm not surprised. I think that's where we are with judicial nominations. I don't expect Senator McConnell to engage in unilateral disarmament. If there are leaders that want to get together and come up with a new set of rules and norms for how we handle judicial nominations, that would be great. But I wouldn't have expected him to back off that position.
Professor Vladek.
I guess I'm not sure how it's unilateral disarmament to be something that's never been done before, except by your own party. I mean, I think, you know, it was one thing for McConnell to say he's leaving open a seat that opened in February of a presidential election year, you know, to do it when, you know, he might have as much as 18 months, almost 2 years in office, I don't think the Senate has a constitutional obligation to confirm nominees, but I do think that that would be, you know, just sort of further escalation, a further race to the bottom in our confirmation process. We shouldn't be averse to the idea that a Senate of one party might confirm nominees of another, and yet that's where we're going.
Jonathan, that is a departure, and I pointed it out to Leader McConnell that the Kennedy nomination began originally in Bork in 87 and got done in 88. Isn't that upping the stakes a bit by Leader McConnell?
Well, he didn't answer your question on 2023, and I think the standard that he applies is when the political season begins, which is the standard that then-Senator Biden had articulated. And if the political season begins that much earlier, it seems it would apply. I would note that for lower court vacancies, we had this approach used for pivotal seats on appellate courts going back as early as 1987. We saw it on the Fourth Circuit for well over a year before. So the idea that the opposition party would hold seats open for the express purpose of having them filled after an election wasn't something McConnell innovated. He just had the first opportunity to apply it to the Supreme Court. Last quick point, many believe that one of the reasons Doug Ginsburg withdrew so quickly after the Bork nomination failed was because there was a widespread belief that his nomination would have been delayed through the election.
Well, I was there at the time. You boys were too young. I was there. He got withdrawn because of the dope. Steve, I got to ask you about my premise for the leader was that it would be a mainstream liberal. In other words, not a hard left, critical legal scholar, but just sort of a Breyer or a Kagan. That's what surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, but we already saw that too with Merrick Garland. I mean, Leader McConnell's efforts to denigrate Judge Garland notwithstanding, no one, at least on my side of the universe, thinks of Judge Garland as especially liberal. I think the Garland precedent, and let's be clear, it was a precedent, is, you know, one that I think should really sort of weigh heavily on everybody as we go into this. The notion that, you know, someone who, I mean, let's be clear, who President Obama picked because he was perceived as a moderate, at least among Democratic circles, right? And in the process, President Obama pissed off his own base. If that wasn't good enough for McConnell in February of an election year, you know, Jonathan says it's when the political cycle begins. Well, when are we not in the political cycle these days? So
now, I'm going to have to warn these law professors. This is an FCC regulated fine bearing forum. So we're not in the free market. You got close there to the seven deadly words, Stephen. That would cost me $1 million per every outlet of my 400 outlets. So please, Jonathan, what Steve, though, just jumped over is that it isn't the Garland precedent. It's the election year precedent because Leader McConnell declared, and people like me were saying, no hearings, no votes. It didn't matter who the nominee was. Could have been a Republican originalist, and we would have said no hearings, no votes.
Right. I think that was McConnell's position, and I think that it should be understood that way. I think we should recognize that if the senators of both parties want to get together and revise the Senate rules to create standards for how quickly nominees are considered, how quickly they do or don't get votes, what you do in election year, they could do that. It does not seem to me that there is much interest on either side. Instead, you see people talking about expanding the size of the court. So, you know, if folks want McConnell to relax his position, there needs to be some offer or some possibility of having a new set of norms. I don't think we have that.
All right, now to the court at hand. Steve Vladeck, what is at stake with the rest of the term, very short-lived, weeks, not months ahead of us?
Yeah, I mean, we've got 17 more decisions we expect to you in argued cases, which, you know, should be noted, means we're going to have the second fewest decisions in argued cases since 1862. I think that's an interesting development that doesn't get enough attention. Obviously, we're gearing up for a big decision on the ACA. There's a major religious liberty case out of Philadelphia. There's, I think, an under-the-radar but really important voting rights case out of Arizona. You know, I think we're going to get all those decisions sometime between now and July 1st.
Now, Jonathan, run down those. You persuaded me the ACA is going to be a loser for conservatives who hope it is a reversal of the famous Roberts decision. What are you predicting on these three cases and why?
Well, the ACA will not be struck down. The real question is how they get there. on the religious liberty case in Philadelphia, the Catholic Service Organization will win. The question is whether or not the Supreme Court overturns the Smith decision, which would increase the scrutiny that is applied to government policies that have the effect of excluding religious organizations or discriminating against religious organizations. So that's what I predict there. The voting rights case, I think, is similar. Arizona's laws, in my view, a rule against ballot harvesting and a rule on how when ballots are thrown out for being cast in the wrong precinct. I think those provisions will be upheld as not being violations of the Voting Rights Act. The real question is how far the court goes in narrowing the extent of scrutiny that is applied to state measures that are challenged under the Voting Rights Act.
Now, Steve, do you agree with those guesses? And by the way, for the audience, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is not a prohibition on getting to Smith in the Philadelphia case because it's a city regulation, not a federal one. Go ahead, Steve. What are your predictions, and do you agree or disagree with Johnson?
I think Johnson's right. I mean, I think the devil's going to be in the details. In the ACA case, how much of the statute do they sever if they find the individual mandate to now be unconstitutional? Do they go after Smith, et cetera? So, you know, Hugh, I think that the key is not the bottom lines of these cases, but the specifics. I think it's also worth stressing, you know, two other related points. Folks are going to look at the next couple of weeks as sort of the be-all, end-all of the term. I actually think we've already had what's probably the most important decision the court handed down this term in sort of pure doctrinal terms, which is the free exercise clause case the court decided on its shadow docket, involving California's in-home gathering restrictions. And the other piece, Hugh, is, you know, this term is going to be a big deal. Next term is shaping up to be a blockbuster. I mean, we've already got grants on the Second Amendment, on a pretty frontal assault on Roe. You know, the court just asked the federal government the other day to weigh in on this really high-profile Harvard affirmative action case. So I think, you know, this time next year, we're going to be underwater with major Supreme Court decisions in the run-up to the 2022 midterm.
I agree with that. By the way, that's why I don't think Stephen Breyer is retiring. It'll be the most consequential term of the last 20. Jonathan, as we look forward on the Harvard case, I am praying that they grant cert on my alma mater's practices. I don't know that they will. Asking the Biden Justice Department was clever because it makes them get on the record when otherwise they might have just blamed the Trump administration. What do you think happens there?
I think the court is probably likely to take it, but I think it will be a while. I don't think it's going to be part of next term. I think it'll probably get punted to the following term. I think between guns and abortion, the justices might think they're dealing with enough red meat for a single term next year.
Steve, I think using Harvard as the platform, as opposed to your own university where you're teaching, and UT was the last time around on this issue of affirmative action, John Roberts is ready to do this. He's declared it in Seattle. The answer to the racial discrimination is to stop using racial discrimination. I think he's probably at the bit. What do you think?
I guess I'm less convinced, too, because of that all-important public-private distinction. I mean, right, the theory on which Harvard's policies are illegal as opposed to unconstitutional requires a very different line of legal analysis about the relevant federal statutes, as opposed to in the Seattle case, you know, in the Michigan cases before Chief Justice Roberts joined the court, where we're talking about the meaning of the Equal Protection Clause. So I guess, you know, I'm not as sort of convinced that the court would be taking this to strike down all even private university affirmative action policies. I do think, though, that, you know, the one message that Monday's action, calling for the views of the acting Solicitor General, clearly sends is that this is not just a case they're going to, you know, duck. They're clearly interested, even if they're willing to stretch it out a couple of years.
Last quick question. I must compliment you. You two are both just as good as, but faster than Eastman and Chemerinsky. I love that. I love speed. Speed doesn't kill. It thrills a radio audience. Does Breyer retire, Jonathan Alder?
No. I think he wants one more year.
Steve Lodeck, does Breyer retire?
Yes, but not till August.
Oh, wait a minute. Why?
Sort of to, you know, to throw everyone for a loop. It would be vintage Breyer.
Jonathan and Steve, thank you. Smart Guys 2.0, they'll be back. And I think you'll like them because they are fast, they're smart, they're funny, and they're polite, which is the essence of Smart Guys 1 and 2.0. And by the way, Jonathan Irwin will be back, but you just can't get him up. I mean, really, you'd think it was the end of the world to get them out of bed before 6 a.m., but that's the way they are.